Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. I'm Paula. Women are going to college in increasing numbers and graduating in increasing numbers. Roughly half of all PhDs are now granted to women. Yet they continue to be underrepresented in senior positions in all parts of American society. Marianne Mason set out to change the work environment for everyone's benefit.
In all the surveys you take of both men and women, they would rather have more time than more pay. And men also are very concerned that they... Lifestyle has become very important to this young generation. Lifestyle means life balance, that work is not everything. And that's very heartening. So the revolution probably will come from the bottom, and it might come just by people voting with their feet and not staying in places that aren't treating them well in a way in which they can balance their lives.
Successful doesn't necessarily mean a fat bank account.
No, by
no means. Successful can be a happy family.
Right. And successful also means feeling good about yourself, that you feel that you're getting the most out of your life that you think you can.
Marianne Mason served as the first woman dean of the graduate division at UC Berkeley. In that position, she led changes which continue to reverberate throughout higher education in America. Dr. Mason is a lawyer, historian, researcher, and author. In 2007, she published Mothers on the Fast Track. Bill Russell and I knew we were in for a mind-expanding conversation when she stopped in for a visit.
Marianne Mason, I had the pleasure not very long ago of seeing a presentation about women of all colors, white and of color, particularly black, in the suffragist movement, women who were working toward the vote. And I was thinking, I was reading Mothers on the Fast Track at about the same time, and I was thinking, let's see, Marianne Mason talks about the generation of which you and I share as pioneers, and yet you look at the suffrage movement and that too is pioneers, and then you can go back to the pioneers who were...
Yes.
This concept of pioneering is a very important one, and it changes over time, doesn't it?
It does, and unfortunately we seem to have to reinvent it every few generations because we lose a lot of the gains we had. Although if you look back, really, from 1848 to the present, all these women's movements have made a serious change. Doesn't mean it's going to last forever, but they've put something institutionally in place that doesn't die, even if the people lose their fervor for it and become more conservative again.
Why do you pick 1848?
That's the Seneca Falls Convention, Elizabeth Cady Stanton. That was where they got property rights for women in New York State.
Well, and one forgets how totally chattel women
yes.
were. We think chattel in terms of slavery.
Yes. Well,
property rights for women meant women were property.
Yes, that's right. In fact, in that era, if a woman had committed a petty crime, for instance, her husband would stand for her. She was not considered to be responsible. Stand trial for her. She was considered to be a responsibility of her husband, but not an independent person in her own right. So we have come a long way, baby, even though we slide back, move forward, slide back. And I actually heard Tom Brucko just last night talking about his new book on the 60s, and I was very surprised to hear him say the most important lasting result from the Civil Rights Revolution was the position of women and how it changed during that time, and it really did.
I was also thinking about the suffragist movement that then results in women in America getting the vote in 1920, that suddenly nothing happened. They get the vote,
yes.
But virtually nothing changes.
Right.
And that same sort of... one step
forward,
a half step back.
That's right.
But it's only a half step back.
It's only a half step because they haven't lost the right to vote.
Right. Well, not yet.
Not
we'll
yet.
We'll hope that
right.
that continues to be the
right.
case. The pioneering nature of the generation of which you are speaking, you again say in Mothers on the Fast Track, you talk about it was our generation's task
yes.
to break through some doors, and the next generation's task to institutionalize those changes.
Yes.
What is that?
Well, our generation really did break through the doors of all these male-dominated professions, particularly these are what I'm addressing in this book, like law and medicine and the corporate world and the PhD world, academic world. And they broke through so that now there's equal participation, certainly in the early levels, in the training period. But unfortunately, they haven't really managed to stay with it all the way through, so we still have very poor representation at the top in all of these fields. And women often because of family demands mostly now, rather than discrimination, leave these positions before they've really had a chance to get going in them, and we don't allow a way back in. So they didn't institutionalize it in the sense that the next step was supposed to be to basically make the family an equal responsibility between men and women, and to have workplaces that reflected family interests and family values, dare I say.
Dare say. It's a very good word.
That's right.
Just make sure we instantiate it.
Exactly,
well.
and not lose it. And not lose it as we have, because it is a family value for a workplace or the government to say, we treasure our working men and women and their families, and we're going to make life possible for them, as opposed to, we're going to make this a rat race so that you're bound to fail if you have a family. And that seems to be the way of business today, and the way of law and the academic world is speed up, not slow down. And the demands are greater even than they were when our pioneering generation came through.
I want to come back to this, I'm sure, but you point out that the, somewhere in there, say that the perfect employee is the employee that puts work ahead of everything
else. Yes.
Which creates serious challenges that we can come back to.
When we come back, and we'll even talk about what perfect might be. This is the Paula Gordon Show. It's our great pleasure to be with Mary Ann Mason. We hope that you'll be with us when we return in just a moment. Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Conversations with people at the leading edge. Mary Ann Mason is with us. Bill, you were talking about the perfect employee. Well, let's consider what perfect might be here.
Well, perfect for most employers means someone who is willing to work round the clock if necessary, to travel at the drop of a hat or handkerchief, and to really have their first priority is their workplace. And again, these fast-track professions that I've been studying, the academic world and law and medicine and the corporate world, they really want to try you out at the very beginning. I call it the make or break years between the ages of 30 and 40, when most people have finished their training in law or academia or even in medicine, and they are about to launch into their career. And the first 10 years are always the most critical in terms of how they will fare. And if they fare well, then they will continue on the fast track. If they don't, then they will either be thrown out entirely, as there's an academic world where tenure is up or out, or they will be shunted to a second tier, to middle-level management, etc. For women, those are also the years, happily, I suppose, that they reproduce, if they reproduce at all. Most American women who are college-educated have their children after the age of 30 now. Mm. We've changed the clock in that direction, and partly because the training has become long and women are so engaged in the training and in the workplace. But it's a double whammy because during those 10 years, they have to do both.
And it is those 10 years.
Those 10 years.
30 to 40.
Exactly.
One could think, oh yeah, those 10 years, 20 to 30, but that's not the case.
No, it's the 30 to 40, which is the critical decade. And it's the one in which I think if we're going to focus our attention in terms of workplace reforms or any kind of personal or structural changes, that's the decade in which we're losing women. We have very clear evidence that that's when the pipeline starts to lose the best and brightest women, or many of the best and brightest women.
We did some benchmarking a few years back, within the last decade, principally around gender in the corporate environment. And what we thought we found, and I don't think this is discrepant, but it's a little different, is there was a line of women by age. Above that, they were essentially assimilationists. They had become, if they'd reached senior levels, they were assimilationists. They had adopted the mannerisms, the string ties, the suits, all of those things. Below that, there was a fairly substantial, in fact, Deloitte & Touche, which you mentioned
yes.
at some length, was one of those companies that was trying to overcome that. Below that, there were a lot of women that were getting up to that and leaving. And part of what appeared to be happening, the way we interpret it, was a lot of them, and this goes to the perfect employee, got to that point, realized what was involved, what the rewards were, what the payoff was, and what the cost was.
Yes.
And just said, this isn't worth it.
Yes.
In terms of living my life. And
yes.
We're exiting, not necessarily, I mean, they weren't going home necessarily. They were starting their own businesses.
Right.
They were doing a lot of different things, but they were, in this case, walking out of the corporate environment.
Right. I think they walk out of the corporate environment because this isn't working, and our research shows that it's largely because they have family concerns. Either I want to have a family or I already have a child, and it's true, they don't walk out, they don't stay at home. The notion of women opting out and staying at home happily is really not the reality. First of all, women can't even afford to stay at home, but if they could, they still have been well-trained and they have ambition and they want to do something. So certainly in the corporate world, most new businesses now are started by women. And usually small businesses, they become the entrepreneurs of the corporate world, or they'll do consulting. What they don't do, though, is stay in those big corporate models and become the CEO of a Fortune 500 company, because those corporate worlds are not going to let them do that on their schedule that they need to have when they're between 30 and 40 or 45. With a more flexible workplace, which is really what you said, Deloitte and Touche did, their aim was to retain women. And to do this, they offered enormous amount of flexibility at all times in life, but particularly in the years that I'm talking about when they had small children. And they managed to have more than 90% retention rate and have a very, very profitable outcome from this.
And their intention was not just to keep women. What they really wanted, I mean, this was a business decision.
Yes.
Exactly. They just weren't being good guys.
Yes. Exactly.
What they realized is that they were losing half of the intellectual brain.
Exactly.
And they
exactly.
had
it wasn't
put a tremendous investment into
these exactly.
young people who were coming out well-trained
yes.
from their schooling. That they had pumped lots of energy and money and resources into these people.
Yes.
And it was very, very costly to them. So,
yes,
they're a nice company, and the strict business sense of this, which to us looked like a perfectly reasonable thing for a business to be considering.
Yes.
And it would seem to me that that's some of what needs to be examined.
As, yes.
As you're looking across the academia, medicine, law, and the corporate world, that there are real costs
yes.
to not paying attention to your women.
Yes, and I think part of the problem there is, in the academic world, you can see those real costs very, very directly, because you're the ones who are educating and doing the training, which is very costly. And then they go on to start their job somewhere else, so they don't necessarily see the whole cost. The corporation or the university doesn't see the whole cost of that particular training, but what they're losing is enormous amount of talent that someone else has trained in many cases. Or in the university world, they're losing the very same people they've trained, which mm-hmm. is particularly dumb. You take a class and have 50% of all PhDs today are women, and yet you see 20% in the professoriate at the major universities, and they're just losing it entirely in terms of making a good economic bet on these women.
In addition to the intellectual capital,
yes.
the social capital.
Yes.
Well, corporations, in my experience, I was going to say they're the worst about it, but universities have their own challenges, too.
Yes.
These are monocultures, and as much as anything, it's not a word I think that you use, but essentially they're, you know, these are monocultures. There's one way to do it. There is a standard model, you know, white male something 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 driven, whatever.
Yes.
You know, but there's a neat set of categories, or a fairly straightforward set of categories, and as much as anything, the real loss is in that broadening the culture, mm-hmm. particularly as we have to engage and even and do business and communicate across broad cultures in a relatively dynamic environment, not to have to insist on maintaining a monoculture, which is what happens if you,
yes.
if you don't change the structural things that you point to.
Yes.
And it seems to me, both in terms of the effectiveness of the institution, whether it's economic effectiveness or the quality of the teaching or whatever, but also in terms of the culture itself, the
yes.
broader culture, the community, that's what really matters in this, is the opportunity to learn from a lot of different experiences and a lot of different perspectives.
Yes, on all fronts. All these cultures have changed somewhat, but more often to the worse. At the universities, for instance, now most undergraduate classes are taught by part-time or adjuncts, and these are primarily the women they've trained as PhDs. Because they, excuse me, they can get them cheaper, and the women have no choice but to take these jobs or nothing at all. So it's a very exploited labor class. Similarly, in law firms, only 16% of partners in major law firms are women, even though they start out with about the same number of associates going through the track. But they will often keep women as contract lawyers or non-equity partners and basically have created a second tier, which is in a business model, they think they're getting cheap labor, but what they're getting is a very underutilized and very dissatisfied second tier.
And the dissatisfaction has its costs as well.
Of course it does. They're not going to be ideal employers. They're going to be very angry employees, or at least at best, they'll just do their job and go home. They will not give it the full attention that they would if they actually were part of the regular
track.
As if they were part of the mainstream track of the university or corporation.
Thank you.
Part of the fast track.
You say that in most urban areas, you cannot raise a child on a single income.
Yes.
Which, everything else aside, says that, I mean, the argument, the neo-mamanistas.
What?
The new momism. would have you believe that this is optional and that women are working because they want their fingernails painted or something. But I had not seen it quite that starkly put, that if you're going to raise children at a certain level, and presumably this is not an extravagant level, in an urban environment, which increasingly is where people live, that a single income is simply not sufficient. This is not optional.
No, it's not optional. And women who are in those situations might leave jobs for which they were well-trained and doing brilliantly and take a really second tier or some. Often they'll work from home or do consulting, not use their talents because they can't afford not to work in some way or another. But they certainly aren't getting the most out of the workplace. They're not giving the most to the workplace, and the workplace is suffering.
There's another piece that you go by. You don't confront it directly because that's not what this book is about. We every now and then argue about health care in this country, and we have chosen to tie health care and pensions to the job,
yeah.
Which, you know, we sort of take for granted because that's the way it's always been around here. But it seems to me that that's a really important part of this, because if the only way you can get health insurance, as an example, at a time of escalating cost, if the only way you can get pension benefits is through your work, then you are coerced into taking a job, regardless, simply in order to have the benefits.
Yes.
All of which we will discuss when we come back in just a moment. Your timing was impeccable. We'll be back in a moment.
I try.
With Mary Ann Mason. Be with us when we return. Dr. Mary Ann Mason, Esquire, is our guest here on the Paula Gordon Show. Russell was just asking her about the connection between work, pensions, health care. There's a sort of involuntary servitude going on in here, isn't there, that you just have to work?
I ask this because this is a big problem.
Yes,
this goes to the entire way we earn our livings, but
yes.
Also who and what we are as a community, as a political entity.
Well, you're certainly right about that. And if you're a single mother particularly, you really, really have to take a job that will give you benefits no matter what, gives you very little choice. In this particular group that we're looking at, most of these people have partners, so they bargain. Somebody's got to have the insurance and the other one can do what they want. But you're right, it's one of the trade-offs and one of the bargains that people shouldn't have to make in life, that they have to be tied to a job just because they can't afford not to have their medical benefits. But you see this, of course, all the time with American couples.
Well, it makes it exploitive.
Yes.
Which contaminates the relationship between
yes.
the employer and employee.
Yes.
And in the short term, it looks like a clever thing to do, because essentially you've got a labor force that you have access to. You might have to pay them more, variety of different kinds of things.
Right.
But in the long term, by which I mean anything over 2 weeks, it seems to me that's counterproductive for everybody involved.
I agree with that.
You talk in Mothers on the Fast Track about a very specific part of the workforce and a specific part of womankind, if you will,
right.
in America.
Right.
It is interesting to watch you develop the numbers and then begin to apply it to policy, particularly within the academy, and to have this echo in two directions, both Mary Ann Mason's experience and Mary Ann Mason's daughter Eve Mason Ekman's experience as you together did this book, and as your lives have been entwined, of course, as mother and daughter all the way through.
Yes.
But to me it is interesting to see the stories behind the numbers.
Yes.
Did some of this come out of the living it as well as the studying it? I mean, yes, you're an academic. Yes, you're a lawyer and an historian.
Yes. Yes.
So you have lots of skills, but that the breathing part is important too, isn't it?
Yes. And it came out of my own life, of course. I think most of us write about, on some level, the things we care about and have experienced. In my own case, growing up in the pioneer generation, there were lots of doors that were closed to begin with. And then when I did, in fact, in my second career, my first career was in academia, my second career was law, begin a career in law, I was divorced and a single mother and experienced what a lot of mothers do, that they just can't cope if they don't have a lot of support when they have small children. I didn't have any support, and I dropped out of practicing law. It's about that class of women, largely because these are the people that are my graduate students, and I have in other books written about working class women and very poor women. But in this case, I was looking at essentially, the main thrust of the feminist movement was that there would be equality in the workplace. And that didn't mean that you could have as many women truck drivers as men truck drivers. That's okay, too. But they were really concerned about power and power and status. And these mean going into the powerful status kinds of professions and organizations. To have that kind of power and status also means that you are making the world. You are setting the agenda for America. You are the captains of industry, you're the head of universities. You're becoming the most important political voices and public voices if you have that kind of bearing and status in the world. Women still don't have that, and without that, frankly, we're always second-class citizens. You don't hear this much anymore. You don't hear those old kind of 70s complaints that we need to be equal at all levels.
It's more than complaints. They are critiques. They are observations. And to say complaints sounds like whining, and that's not the case. This is about, as you say, and eloquently, this is about equity. It is about power. It is about what kind of a world do we want.
Yes.
It is about having voices that have not been heard. It's about perspectives that for which the world is yearning and deeply in need.
Exactly.
So the ability for women to be on the fast track and not have to roll over, not have to give way on the subject of having children, is still a very important subject, even though it doesn't get talked about in this new Mamanistas yourself, Bill. This new
Neo Mamanista.
This momism, mm-hmm. that has been very, very much supported and enhanced by some fairly radical right wing thinkers, that women should go back to
what
never existed.
Yes.
And to roll back genuine advances.
Yes.
Tremendously problematical on the best day and deeply destructive if we are not willing to say, no, that's not acceptable. Let's go back and try this again. So the notion of this new momism is one to which if we don't stand up, there are tremendous prices to be paid.
Well, for one thing, medical schools, law schools, universities will think twice about admitting women if they're going to be leaving the workforce as they are and not fulfilling their professional goals. I wanted to write this book with my daughter because I wanted her to interview all these women of my generation and younger to get a sense of what this was all about, why it was important, these individuals, how they cope, what they fought for. One of the people she interviewed was actually one of my classmates from college, and she was the leader of the first Newsweek class action suit on the part of proofreaders and copy editors, because Newsweek had no real editors who were women. They had the copy editors, no senior writers, nothing. And they won that class action suit. It took them 3 years and a lot of grief, and they got Eleanor Norton Holmes to represent them. And at the end of that, my friend actually was made one of their first senior editors, and then she was one of the founding members of Working Women's magazine, and they opened that door. Now, my daughter had been working in the media. She'd been working in a magazine, GQ. She didn't know that. She didn't know anything about that. But she did know, working at GQ and in the Condé Nast building and seeing all of these magazines there, almost one building, which includes the New Yorker and Harper's and all kinds of practically the most important news magazines in the world, that the lunchroom was filled with very young women who were in their 20s, usually in early 30s, and only a few older people, and those were more men than women. Those were the senior editors. So that's an industry that's built on the backs of women, always has been, young women, because they are basically worked, and then they are mostly the pyramid at the top, even in publishing, which is far more feminine-oriented in terms of its working force than others. Mostly they drop out. It's very pyramidal. And it wasn't until she started interviewing people that it occurred to her that what she was interviewing and things I had told her and things she had read actually had some relevance. Here I am. I'm one of those. I'm one of those young workers, and I'm going to get washed out, and do I want this to be washed out, etc. It made her really reflective and think about it. So, among other things, if I made her think about it, I hope that I'll make other young women and their mothers and their fathers and other young men, because, in fact, we can't change a workplace. We really can't change any of these institutions unless young fathers also get involved. This is a parental issue. If it's only women who take the flexible leave, ultimately that will die. At California, the University of California, we put in place substantial changes for parenthood and mothering and fathering so that men and women get a year off their clock, their tenure clock, if they have a child. In the case of childbirth, women get 2 semesters without teaching, but men get 1. And men are starting to take this, which makes them enthusiastic rather than critical or just sometimes downright envious that, you know, women can get this time off and they can't. It's been
Why do you say men have to do this for women to succeed at it?
Because if there is a mommy track, a part-time track that only women take, then it becomes fast marginalized. And women who are on this mommy track will not be taken as seriously when they come up for tenure or promotion or whatever. It's really important that both the company buys into it, Deloitte and Touche did, but men buy into it as well and participate as well. Now, nothing in life is ever totally equal, so there might be my turn, your turn, and it's not necessary that everybody has to do exactly the same thing, but there has to be a notion that this is, you know, participation by all. No one says, I think, in a workplace, well, I'm not going to pay my sick insurance because I never get sick, and I'm very angry that Joe Smith gets sick. You pay it because you know that you might get sick as well. You pay it for the good of everyone, for the general well-being. And this is similar to any kind of parental leave. A lot of people are not necessarily parents, and I think particularly the older generation of women who didn't have children sometimes very much resent these parental modifications, and men do too. So it has to be something that people fully participate in, or at least understand why the participation is important for a healthy and creative workforce.
I found myself examining the notion of fast track. Mm-hmm. What does this mean? What are the underlying values? What are the assumptions that go with it? And the track, of course, is very linear.
Yes, exactly.
And it does have a race that somebody wins and somebody loses.
That's right.
Well, I'm really thinking, I think the railroad track.
Yeah.
I mean, that to me at least is the stereotype, at least in my mind, which is linear and doesn't allow for deviations. And it occurs to me, particularly in the case of university, which has for a long time recognized the importance of sabbaticals.
Yes.
As a way of stepping back,
exactly,
refreshing the gene pool of, you know, your mind, or, you know, just stopping. Just,
yes,
just to take a deep,
yes,
breath of air, maybe look at things a little bit differently.
Yes.
That same process is equally important in anything that requires the kind of imagination and thinking and skill that is compatible with the degree of education.
Yes.
The reason we've educated these people is presumably these are not just trade schools. We really want people to be to have a broad view of the world around them. And if you're locked on that track, and you're all you see day after day after day is, you know, what's directly in front of
yes.
you, you get stale. Yes. Unimaginative. You let things go by, you get in a rut, all those kinds of negative things. And it would seem that this greed aside,
yes,
which is a big part of the challenge.
And universities are not supposed to be greedy, right?
Well, that's
yes.
Economics aside, which is not irrelevant, right. Obviously. I mean, it obviously is a central driver in this. But that aside, the importance of just refreshing the system would seem to be essential to all of these professions.
Yes.
Which you talk about.
And the reason he's talking about the fast track is that Mary Ann Mason and her daughter Eve Mason Ekman have written Mothers on the Fast Track, How a New Generation Can Balance Family and Careers. The three of us will be back in just a moment with this when we return. This is the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. It is our great pleasure to be with Mary Ann Mason. Dr. Mary Ann Mason, also a lawyer, most recently the Dean of the Graduate School at the University of California, Berkeley, Bill Russell. I, Paula. Dr. Mason, the notion of how do you take an enterprise, whether it is a profession, the university itself, the corporate world, and keep it fresh, keep it flexible, adaptive,
yes,
in a dramatically changing time, and make sure you have used all of the, and I say used with the double entendre intended, use your human resource in such a way that you are forwarding the enterprise's ends, economics aside. These things are very relevant to everything, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And I think his notion of the sabbatical being the time in which you refresh your creative energies, it's not just true for the university. It's something that would be very useful in all professions, but particularly those that depend on energy and creativity and new ideas at all times, which is the group that we've been looking at here.
That kind of creativity,
yes,
and the need for innovation, all of those things really need this kind of thinking, don't they, Dr. Mason?
They do, and I think Bill mentioned that universities have grown very accustomed to sabbaticals, and it just becomes a way of life, and they understand the concept. That doesn't mean they were giving it for mothers or any other reason or flexibility. Now they are, and partly it was the analogy to sabbaticals that made it possible to convince the universities that, particularly our University of California, that flexibility at many times during the career are necessary and will ultimately make a better employee. I don't see this so much in the corporate world or in law offices. It's a little bit too much now or nothing. But again, I think this is a good time because there are enough corporations who are taking a leading edge. Deloitte and Touche is only one of them. There are others in the Silicon Valley. Many of these companies pride themselves on being family friendly, and they have on-site daycare. They have cafeterias that are open 24 hours, etc. And they do this partly because they want to keep their employees happy. They want to keep them there. They want to hold on to them when other companies are bidding after them. So competition is a really important motive as well. That's just easy for all corporations to understand, that if another company does something that's attracting the best women workers or the best men because they're family friendly, this will make a difference in terms of whether they're going to get the best employees.
I was really struck when you went back in Mothers on the Fast Track to talk about the passage in 1971, if I remember correctly, of a genuinely family-friendly policy coming from the federal government that Richard Nixon vetoed,
yes,
because it scared him that it looked like communism.
Yes.
Well, that's silly. let's see, the Soviets take care of their children, so we don't want to. Is that it? The way that these things intersect, the fact that the extremist wrong wing in America wants to push women back home in a fundamentalist sense,
yes,
these big overlying political things also have direct impact on all of these enterprises that together come together as a culture, as a society, and vice versa.
Yes. Well, it's really quite shocking. In addition to not having health care or pension plans, we also don't have any kind of daycare system, because all of the leading industrial nations have a system in place that is far better. At least they have something. We have nothing in that regard. And that's a good point, that it was 1971, because that was really kind of the peak of the women's movement. And, of course, it was the peak of Richard Nixon. It didn't last too much longer than that. So these two ideologies were kind of coming head to head. And the women's movement did not carry on with the idea of daycare or changing the workplace, etc. That idea rather got lost for about 30 years. Now it's coming back again strongly, because I think there's a real recognition that we need daycare, universal daycare. We need all kinds of family paid leave. It's only unpaid at the moment, not just for the fast-track women, of course, but for all working mothers. And we don't seem to have the political collective will to go in that direction, nor do we seem to have a collective voice that's asking for it in the way that the women's movement not only asked for it, it really pushed for it and brought all kinds of lawsuits, etc. Frankly, I think the time is very good for all of these issues. No one is really saying no. They're just not really doing it because they're not getting pushed strongly enough. They'll get pushed in the private market. This is happening in the universities and in universities and in the corporations. And it will also happen, of course, in law firms and the medical world, when the competitive edge is to better support families. And people go to a university. I just heard from a young assistant professor the other day that he and his wife had come to Berkeley. I said, why did you come here rather than MIT where they had been? He said, oh, because we hear you have great family-friendly policies. Well, I mean, he didn't know me, or he knew me, but he didn't know that I'd been involved with this kind of work at all. And yet it was paying off. It was paying off for everyone. So there are many reasons why family-friendly policies are necessary and important, but it makes good business sense as well as other kinds of sense.
I found myself reading, particularly the first part of this, going through the statistics, listening to the, you know, the half-full version of this, and thinking, well, what about the rest of the OECD? What are other developed countries doing? Countries
yes.
that have the same cultural predicates that we do, and being the perceptive person you are, if I'd just been patient, I could have read a few more chapters, and there it was. But it's, you know, that's yeah. one of the things that seems to me to be important. This is not an experiment,
yeah.
necessarily.
No.
Others have done it?
Yes.
Nothing wrong with experiments, but yeah. we don't even have to do that. There are other countries that have done some very
right.
interesting things.
There are very good models. Now, it's always true that no country is exactly like your country. But what other countries have done, most notably, I think France actually is quite a model in this direction, in the Scandinavian countries, of course, we know about. Their culture has moved in this direction for a long time now. They've had, for instance, they give baby bonuses to everyone. It's not just for the very poor, because babies and families are important, and everyone gets free health care. But everyone also gets free, not free, but inexpensive child care from early days on, and good free public schooling. So they have a commitment to their society putting their efforts into maintaining the family in all ways. And this also accommodates working mothers, partly because they know they need the working mothers for their economy. Germany just recently is really finally coming to put in a lot of family-friendly policies in place, largely because they want to get the women more involved in the workplace, because they haven't got enough workers and they're pushed to it by that reason. In America, we've always assumed that people take care of themselves. It has to be a personal solution. But there are many things we can't personally solve. It has to be done at a different level. We can't personally solve a workplace that works 60 hours a week and will not accommodate for children. We can't personally solve the fact that we don't have medical insurance for children if we leave our workplace. There are many things that need to be collective decisions. There's a certain amount of individual effort and imagination that we can each use, but the large structural things have to be attacked in a collective way.
And you say that's the task of the pioneers' daughters and granddaughters.
Yes, and of course, it's their task to get the message out. The people that will make it actually work are the politicians and others, but there doesn't seem, again, even to be the political will for my daughter's generation to get together.
Well, politicians follow, they don't lead.
Exactly. And so they have to demand it, and there hasn't been the demand.
Well, but I also want to give credit where credit is due. I very impressed with what you personally and with the people you work with at Berkeley have been able to accomplish, both within the institution itself, the family-friendly, but it's much bigger than that.
Yes, it
is. Family-friendly, you know, it doesn't begin to cover the subject. And what you call restructuring the workplace.
Yes.
Which is, you know, what you apply across the board. But you not only have written about it, you've actually participated in making the kinds of changes at Berkeley, but not only at Berkeley, but at other higher institutions. And part of it, I'm sure, is the competitive
pressure. It is.
But that to me, is a cause for hope. And it also means we don't have to dump the whole burden off on your daughter.
Well, good point. Good. Because she's not willing to take the whole burden. But it also shows that it's possible to be done, and it's not, you don't really have that much counterforce, because everyone recognizes that it's a useful thing to have. And once you bring it up, of course, you have an enormous amount of support from working parents at the university who see this as, you know, why didn't this happen earlier? Or people who have had to drop out of the university world. If only they'd had this in place, I could have helped. And I particularly started with my graduate students, because we did a survey which showed that they changed their goals from the beginning. Men and women at the beginning of their career, more than 50% wanted to be professors at major research universities, and another 27% at four-year colleges. But after a couple of years as a PhD student, they said, hell no, I don't want that life. You know, that, this is just too difficult. I don't see how I can not take a break. And women, particularly, when they're more likely to change their goals away, and the main reason was, I don't see how I can fit a family into this. So we tried to make it possible for them to see being possible as parents when they're graduate students, and assistant professors, and all the way through, and how we can
summarize how you did that?
Well, a number of different steps, starting from the beginning of the pipeline. For the graduate students, we offer, you know, paid maternity leave, family housing, a student-parent bonus, stopping the clock for graduate students. And again, the most important thing is for the advisors, for the professors themselves, to get the message and become acculturated and not believe that when a student has a child, they're going to be lost to the world of science or to the world of literature. When, unfortunately, at the current time, when a male student has a child, they think, this guy's now going to be a straight-up Joe and going to work hard, hard, hard. When a woman has a child, they think, not serious. We're not going to take her seriously anymore. So that double standard is very, very active in the university and elsewhere, I think. So starting with the graduate school years, making sure that the faculty and the chairs know exactly what the new rules are and what the consequences are if you don't follow them. There have actually been a number of suits against universities who have shown any kind of discrimination based on parental issues, let's put it that way, which is always a way in which universities listen up. And then for faculty, from the beginning, using family-friendly policies to attract young families, men and women, dual career, very important issue in all of these industries and institutions, try to accommodate the, as they call them, the trailing partner, including resettling, relocation with housing, for their children to figure out how to send their kids to school. Many things that you can do as an employer to recruit the best people by showing attention to their family and to their family needs. And then, of course, as I mentioned, the time off the clock for childbirth, the part-time track. Interestingly, because we surveyed all the UC faculty across the 10 campuses, a huge majority of both men and women wanted a part-time track at some time during their life. A lot of them thought in terms of their older years or their parents' older years. So it's not that family responsibilities are just for the very young. It happens all through your life. If you have physical difficulties, which many people do as they move on toward life, to be able to count on the fact that you can take time off and that it's respected and you're not going to lose your place in the line or at your job is extraordinarily important.
This is Dr. Mary Ann Mason, who with her daughter Eve Mason Ekman has written Mothers on the Fast Track, How a New Generation Can Balance Family and Careers. We'll talk about more about how that can be done when we return in just a moment. Dr. Mary Ann Mason is our guest here on The Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell, I, Paula. Dr. Mason, there are a number of things you say we can do. You've just said some of the things that you have put into place at the University of California system, where you have just stepped down as the dean of the graduate school at Berkeley. These are very real things that can happen for the fast track, and in a number of ways, if you will take care of the people in the leadership positions on the fast track, that will affect people who are coming behind them as well, and in what you call the second tier, won't they?
Yes. If there's a realization that you're trying to utilize your intellectual and social capital the best way that you can across all tiers of a university, including all the staff, because there are always more staff than there are faculty, etc. And the second tier, which in the university's case are the part-time lecturers and the adjuncts, if all the consideration is given to each of them with the possibility, particularly in the second tier, of flexible movement within the institution, a career track that isn't dead-ended, then you really utilize your workplace much more strongly. And there are things individuals can do as well, because in fact, we are agents of our own fortune to a certain extent. We're not totally dominated by the institutions in which we serve. I give some suggestions for women, particularly who fall out of the fast track and have to, for a period of a year or more, not pursue their careers. Either they are at home for that period of time or have taken a part-time job, and then feel that they have both the time and the willingness and the ability to come back into the workplace, for them to really make themselves known and to stay in the game while they're out, to continue their professional contacts, to keep in touch with all the mentors they ever knew. And if they're in a kind of position that they publishing makes a difference, as it does in the academic world, to try to continue to follow the literature and to get some publication out if you can, because then you don't become just dead, something that is like yesterday's fish that no one wants to look at. I always talk about discounting the resume gap when give these lectures to faculty, that the fact that someone, man or woman, has been out of the workplace for 5 years does not automatically relegate them to the circular file, which is generally what happens. They don't even get to the first step of an interview. And also for women themselves to make sure, and men themselves, to make sure that the young protégés, the students, the trainees that they've had, if they take some time out, get a welcome back and get a note saying, how are you doing? You're thinking of coming back, etc. Because right now, people who are out of the workplace for more than a couple of years lose their confidence entirely. They feel that they have no credibility and no marketability any longer. So even if they're ready to come back, they often don't feel that there is a way. So the reentry track is enormously important. And individuals can help it by staying in the game, and players can help it by looking seriously at everyone who's shown promise but may have taken a bit of time out. Retraining for 5 or 6 months is often a good investment in recapturing what was once an incredibly valuable employee. And not just looking at, oh my gosh, you're over 40 and you've been out of the workplace for 2 years. In my own case, I started as assistant professor at Berkeley after the age of 40, which was almost unheard of in my time. And it was opposed, in fact, by some of the higher administration. But it worked for me. I was able to do that because I had stayed in the game, though. I had published, kept on publishing a bit in between, and had tried very hard to keep my contacts. That doesn't mean everyone can do it. I think it's very hard to do it that way. But it's one of the techniques.
And one of the things you say is pick your spouse, yes, partner, well.
Don't marry a jerk.
I love that line.
And by that, of course, I mean not just, you know, ordinary jerk, but someone... So should your partner should be someone who takes you and your career as seriously as they take themselves and their career, who really treats you as an equal in all ways. I mean, life is long and you're not always going to be doing the same thing at the same time, but that respect for your life and your career goals, which is more important than anything else, whether you earn more or less money is far less important than the respect that you give one another, as well as the help. And this is not just a man's job or a woman's job, it's a partnership. And a real partnership means you are as important as I am. And surprisingly, I find with interviewing, particularly the women who have dropped out, that many of them say they just couldn't make it because they just didn't have a supportive spouse. And virtually all of the supportive women, including Dianne Feinstein that we interview, give a lot of credit to their partner or spouse. Even if they weren't necessarily doing 50% of the housework, it was just someone who was supportive in any way they could be. And I think that's enormously important.
It seems that part of the challenge, you know, to generalize this, is in the the institutionalization of things, entities, whether it's law firms or medicine or colleges, and the ossification that tends to come with institutionalization. There are two things you point out that seem to be significant in that. One is your daughter in that generation. The attitudes are different, the expectations are different, what they think they can do, and in some cases are doing, seem to offer hope for deinstitutionalizing, or at least institutionalizing in ways that allow us to institutionalize things in a better way than they are now. The other that you don't, because you, I don't think you can get numbers as easily, the other promising thing to me is the whole entrepreneurial class. You mentioned how many women are going and starting their own businesses. And it seems to me that that also is a place where new ideas, new yes. cultures, new institutions
right.
can spring up.
And here I am, yes. the fifth time, saying we'll be back in just a moment.
I timed that perfectly.
With some of those answers when we return. We have a couple more minutes with Dr. Mary Ann Mason, who with her daughter Eve Mason Ekman has written about mothers on the fast track. There's a presumption that we all want to be on the fast track, but don't some of us get to define what that means?
Well, that's a good point. And writing it with my daughter was very enlightening to me as well, because she thought that I was too hidebound. I saw the world from an academic perspective, etc., and that there were many wonderful and creative things that I wasn't considering. And she's right about that in some ways, but I think even if you are a creative, as she is, wonderful, talented young person, you run into the same problems when you have children. It's not really going to be that much different, because then you won't have the time to be an artist or a writer, etc. So you still need the ability to think in the long term.
And those structural things are vital.
And the structural things are absolutely vital to it. But the younger generation, I think we should have hope, because she always says, Mom, the guys are really contributing more now. It's really more like 50%, which is wonderful to hear. She says they're committed to it, and they really care a lot. And in all the surveys you take of both men and women, they would rather have more time than more pay. And men also are very concerned that lifestyle has become very important to this young generation. Lifestyle means life balance, that work is not everything. And that's very heartening. So the revolution probably will come from the bottom, and it might come just by people voting with their feet and not staying in places that aren't treating them well in a way in which they can balance their lives.
And then you were talking about the entrepreneurial as well.
Well, that's part of it. That class requires creativity.
Yes, it is. And as I mentioned, most of the new businesses, more than 50%, are started by women, and some of them become wildly successful. Women, I notice, and I don't have records on this or numbers, so I can't be very precise, but women do a lot of the internet business too. They start internet businesses. Those are things you can do literally on a shoestring from your home and get them going, and you can have a huge market just because you've used the internet very effectively. And also, I mean, the internet and computers do allow you to have more flexibility in the workplace if the employer allows it, even when you're working for a law firm, for instance, or for the university.
I do want to just put a plug in here. Successful doesn't necessarily mean a fat bank account.
No, by no means.
Successful can be a happy family.
Right. And successful also means feeling good about yourself, that you feel that you're getting the most out of your life that you think you can.
And that you can contribute to the rest
yes.
of your family, whether it includes offspring
yes.
or not. And there is that larger...
And to the community.
And
that's
to
what
the
I
community,
was going
to
say. There's
of
the
course.
Larger context of if we were to be paying better attention to the and everything else
yes.
than simply looking at our own children or our own lives or our own job or our own enterprise,
yeah.
that there is this larger structural issue.
Yes.
But all of that takes place in the yeast that is the larger culture to which we can also be contributing. And that's part of success.
All of that is success. And right now we have a very narrowly defined notion of success. Work harder, more, 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 get more, more money. And I don't, of course, mean that at all. Just means doing what you can best do in this world to your best advantage and to the world's advantage.
And people like you in leadership positions really can change things.
Yes, I think that's true. And if there are more women in leadership positions, it's easier to look at the world differently. Now, this is a man's problem as well as a woman, but women are the ones who are generally more alert to considering the change.
I'm just so impressed by what you have done with the positions of both excellence as a professional and then in these leadership positions.
Well, I think no work is worth doing unless you are being able to give it back to the community in some way or another, make a difference in the world.
And you have done that. We thank you.
Marianne Mason has challenged the habits of a scholastic tradition going back to the Middle Ages. She not only proposed major evidence-based changes, she found ways to make those changes happen. We deeply respect all that she has achieved. We treasure her friendship. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.